Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, a guest comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week's guest is Felipe Esparza. Felipe won Last Comic Standing 10 years and 1 month ago. Since then, his standing in the industry has only continued to grow. From his 2012 Showtime special, They're Not Gonna Laugh at You, to his 2017 HBO special, Translate This, and now his recent Netflix special, Bad Decisions, which he released in both English and Spanish, a first. Felipe's stand-up, which he has been performing for nearly 25 years, exhibits a complicated mix of joy and tragedy. The joke we talk about this episode from Bad Decisions is a perfect example of this. Let me first note, Felipe's joke describes a graphic domestic violence dispute from his childhood. I understand this might be hard for some to listen to, so if that's the case for you, you might want to skip this one. In preparing for the interview, I watched the joke many times, and it's clear it being difficult was Felipe's goal. He doesn't want to cover up or gloss over the trauma of the event. However, he is able to find comedy, as well as pathos, in truly capturing the perspective of himself as a little boy and the contrast of being a child dealing with his adult situation. It is a fascinating piece of stand-up. If you can, I recommend trying to listen to where the audience laughs. So, here is Felipe Esparza.
That's why I don't hit my kids, you know, I don't hit them, I don't yell at them. I don't even fucking see them anymore. I remember my mom and dad fighting. My dad came home drunk and punched my mom in the face. She fell to the ground, my little brother jumped in, leave my mom alone! My dad said, shut the fuck up, cabron! I was gonna jump in too, but when I got there, I got scared, started peeing on myself. No. My dad just pushed me, and I just peed on myself. The next day, my mom had a fucking big ass fucking black eye. My brother had a big fucking black eye. I felt like I wasn't part of the family. I just had a rash from peeing. I was on the couch putting fucking chapstick. I felt so bad. My mom was holding my brother like he was a hero. You love mommy, mijo. You wanted mommy to be saved. You're mommy's hero. You're my real son, mijo. I'm crying. She looks at me, tú eres un pinche faggot, cabrón. Pinche maricón, you little bitch. Cry like a little bitch. I'm not a bitch, mama. You're a little bitch, cabrón. That's why you got your ass kicked for talking shit. I woke up my dad. Apa! She didn't learn her fucking lesson. She's still talking shit. I was following my dad with my rash. She was trying to make me feel bad. I'm 9 years old. I'm innocent. What do I know? The next day, my dad felt really bad, but not bad enough to say sorry, you know. He just took us to Disneyland to help us forget about it. Let me tell you, man, that shit was hard to forget. I couldn't even walk at Disneyland. I had a fucking rash. I kept walking like this. My mom was wearing a fucking neck brace. Fucking Mickey Mouse signed it. Whatever this, señor, ¿qué pasó? Pone la fecha, Mickey. Put the date. Memorias. I was traumatized. Donald Duck came around. I started crying. My dad said, how come you're crying? Because that's the way mommy sound when you were choking her. How are you faggot? You're not my son. And that's why I like cocaine.
So I am here with Felipe Esparza. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. What's up, fool?
I'm sure some people listening will be fans, but others might be first introduced to you here. So I thought for some context, it would be helpful for people who have not watched your last special, Translate This, which aired on HBO in 2017. In it, you told the story of coming to LA from Mexico as a kid. For people who didn't see it, can you give them sort of a Cliff's Notes version just for some context?
My dad came over first, and I joke about it. I say he started another family, then came and got us, because it took a while for him to get us back. So my mother and my little brother and my other brother, we crossed the border, but we had passports, but they were not our passports. We borrowed them from our cousins who live in the San Isidro, California.
Yeah.
But one of the passports was for a little girl. So we said, uh-oh. My aunt in Tijuana, Mexico, she said, why don't we just dress up your little brother like a little girl? So for 2 weeks, my little brother was like a method actor. He lived like a little girl for 2 weeks, wearing a little dress. They took away her G.I. Joes, gave her Barbies.
Yeah.
And he became a little girl. Mm-hmm. And we crossed the border and they asked him his name. He said, my name is Patty. And we're still here.
Yeah. Around what age was it? Do you remember?
I guess I was 4 or 5 years old. Probably 5 years old.
Yeah. So what were those first few years in L.A. like for you?
The first few years, we lived in by the 5 freeway. No, the 10 freeway east. Mm-hmm. By Soto exit, I think that's Boyle Heights,
yeah.
By General Hospital. And we lived in a studio apartment. I was so little. I just know that my dad would kick us at night. It was a small little place, yeah. I remember.
Like kick you because of the space or kick
The space, yeah. He'll knee us. It was so small. We slept on the same bed. Mm-hmm. We were so little.
So let's talk about the joke that you chose. First, sort of just broadly, how do you write your stand-up?
In the beginning, like most comedians, I became a student of stand-up. I dug into it as far as I could, like to learn from everyone from the old days, you know. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of books, but I had just came on. I was in rehab, first of all. I was in rehab when I wanted to be a comedian, like when I
I said, I'm going to do this. A Catholic brother, like Nacho Libre type of guy, you know, like he's not a priest, but he works for the archdiocese as a brother, he's devoted brother. He gave us, he told me, give me three things you want to do in your life. And I wrote that I want to be a comedian. I want to go to Italy because I like Olive Garden. And I want to be happy and sober.
Yeah.
So I went to the library. I didn't have a computer. Wi-Fi was not for everybody yet. And I didn't have no laptop. There was no internet. There was only like NetJuno and Earthlink and that noise. So I talked to a librarian at the library. I talked to her like she was my guiding counselor. I said, listen, miss, I want to be a stand-up comic. I have no idea how to start. I could read, but I don't write. I don't know how to write stand-up comedy. So she took me to this section of the library where all the arts are at, like screenplays and our town, all these plays.
Yeah.
Then finally, I mean, we went through everything, man, like Jack Parr, you know, Limericks. Then finally, one book on stand-up writing back in like 1995 or 4, 94. It was Jean Perrette's Comedy Writing Step by Step. And I read the book, didn't understand it because I read it like a book instead of an instructional book. And then I finally read it with a note with a paper and paper. Yeah. And there was little homework after every chapter on how to write a joke. And I basically learned from that book how to brainstorm jokes, which what most comedians could do now naturally without even thinking about it. But as a young comic, you have no idea how to do that. Like, how did he just come up with a joke like that so funny? Yeah. Why is Jay Leno so quick? Why is Cat Williams so quick to come up with a 10-minute set when he just was being heckled, you know? Or how does Mencia just write a whole bit, you know, out of thin air? I seen him get heckled once and like heckled, and he wrote a whole bit about the guy just based on his look and his mannerism, I guess. Joe Rogan the same. Like, how do they do that? I guess it takes time, but on this book, I learned that if you want to write material about dogs, you got to make like a list of all the dogs you can think of without looking them up, you know, without Googling it, you know, that's cheating. And then all the dog names you can think of, and then all the famous dogs you've seen on television, and every funny situation you've seen someone do with a dog, you're pretty much brainstorming there. And then you pretty much try to put a joke together out of a dog. So just brainstorming, writing down dog names and finally constructing material. I think he used to write for, I had to look these people up when I was reading his book, Steve Allen, you know?
Yeah.
He used to write for The Tonight Show before Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
So he would travel with Johnny Carson, and Johnny Carson would say, hey, give me 10 jokes on divorce. So this guy will have to sit down and write down the list again and come up with like 50 jokes. So that's how I learned.
So then what do you do now? So that was like 25 years ago or so. Is that still what you do? I mean,
no.
Yeah. So how do you write now? What is writing now, mean for you?
Now I just, I on my phone, my Galaxy Note 10, I have a recorder. I used to walk around with a tape recorder in the beginning.
Yeah.
I have a cassette with a tape recorder and then a mini disc and then a mini tape. Finally, cell phones. I record all my sets on my phone. I lose my phone. I lose my life. And I listen to it. I learned from some comic named Willie Barcena. He was like the first Mexican-American comedian to do the Tonight Show with Jay Leno like 12 times. And he told me to just carry a notepad And every time you think of a joke, write it down. You know, don't forget about it. Write it down so you can remember later. He said that Jay Leno told him that. So that was advice that Jay Leno told him.
So for a story like this, you know, where did this story live in your mind before you did on stage?
Man, that joke was, I guess, was in my head since the day it happened, you know. The day it happened, I remember that it was in a school night. It was a Tuesday or Wednesday. And my dad came in like totally drunk, like drunk as hell. And, you know, domestic violence started. Mm-hmm. My brother jumped in and my dad punched him in the gut. You know, I was thinking about this moment a day ago. And I was holding back tears because I remember more about the situation.
Yeah.
And I remember that my brother got his wind punched out of him by my dad. My dad was weighing like 235 pounds at the time. And my brother was weighing 115, you know? So, like, if there was, like, when my brother got punched, you saw the, it looked like when Batman punched somebody, kapow, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I didn't jump in. I was too scared to jump in. I just peed on myself. Mm. Yeah.
So what inspired you to start telling it on stage?
Man, what inspired me to tell it on stage was, I guess, I'm sober now.
Mm-hmm.
I have not drank since 2009 or did hardcore drugs, you know, like all that stuff since 2009. So now I guess a person who's sober has to deal with his past, you know, mentally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have dreams about it. But I guess that I've always put it behind me because we never dealt with it as a family. Like, we never sat down and said, you know, that was wrong.
Mm.
We shouldn't have done that. So, one night, I'm at this show where I guess you have to do new material.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be something that no one had ever said before. And if the comedian knows or heard that joke before, that the guy who runs the show, the host, that he goes through your YouTube, he checks everything, he starts listening to a joke he already heard, he gives you a light, it makes you get off.
Yeah.
So I said, I don't want to get off. I want to stay on.
Mm-hmm.
So I just started talking like it was, like I was a speaker speaking to kids about how to deal with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I started talking about it little by little. And then I said that part about, that's why you got your ass kicked.
Yeah.
And then people in the audience laughed. Like, they laughed. Because they're seeing it not as a, they're not seeing it as a grown, you know, as a grown man who's lived life.
Yeah.
Who's seen everything, you know. They're not seeing it as a man who's saying that. They're seeing it as it happened, you know. They're seen as a six-year-old boy saying it. So they feel sympathy, you know. I mean, you would have to be there live, but you could see people, like, get sad and all of a sudden look at each other. They ask, like, what am I laughing at?
Yeah.
Why am I now laughing at this? I just felt bad for him. Now I'm laughing like I never gave a hell about him. And that's comedy, I guess.
It's interesting. I mean, I was going to ask, like, at what point did you know it was something you could do, or what did you think might be funny about it? Is, you know, like, it is a sad story. It came from clearly you processing it as a sad story, you know?
Yes.
How did you sort of, yeah.
My dad, he has never said sorry or I'm proud of you or anything to any of us. I mean, he might've said it to my son right in front of us to make us feel worse.
Mm-hmm.
But he had never said sorry for anything. But he has shown it in a way that's very strange. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just saying that it's only Latino dads. It's every dad out there who has ever dealt with domestic violence or was beaten or abused or beaten by their parents doesn't know how to deal with it, you know, or how to not do it to his kids. Mm-hmm. Or how to talk to, nobody talked to my dad, so my dad not going to talk to, he don't know how to talk to us.
Yeah, yeah.
So my dad would always like, this is crazy. One time my dad went, he came in and he was like violent and broke windows. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, we all went to the zoo. Man, we were scared of every animal.
Yeah.
The only, it's funny. So see, that right there, see how I just said? That's true. Yeah. We were afraid of every animal. Yeah. But as a comedian, I know that's not going to be funny.
Yeah.
I know that that's going to make people feel bad. So I got to change it. So I got to say, my dad took us to the zoo right afterwards. The only animal we were afraid of him was him. He was ferocious.
Yeah.
I mean, we were not in a car with him. We were in a cage with him.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. So was it challenging to work on this
job? Yes.
What were the faces and sort of how did you find ways to overcome that?
The challenges were how to say it without crying. Mm. How to say that joke without crying. Because in the beginning, you know, it was like very personal. And I was holding back like, and then then I would finally get to the punchline. And then like, I'm still like holding back. And I'm saying the joke like it's happening, you know, like. So it took practice.
To go through the joke, sort of, it starts off with like a joke, which is sort of, I don't hit them. I don't yell at them. I don't even fucking see them anymore, which is like a nice joke to set it up. But then once you get into the story, how do you sort of get that first laugh? Or what are you looking for? What are you trying to do to get the audience on board with this?
I'm trying to get the audience attention, you know, and keep them going with the story. Mm-hmm. So I learned this from working a lot of urban rooms, a lot of African-American rooms, you know. I always would watch them, and just like Richard Pryor, you know, a lot of Richard Pryor is in these urban comedians like Mike Epps. But I watched them, you know, and one of the guys told me, Felipe, if you're going to work this room, you're going to have to add more to the story, you know. If you're going to say you're going to walk into the room, you're going to make a joke about the noise you made walking into the room, you know. Like you say, man, I was walking in a room, and you say, man, I was stepping on broken glass. And then you get to the joke. That's why I wrote that joke before. And then somehow I wrote, I said, I never see my kids, but my dad, one time he came home drunk, mm-hmm. like most dads. And then I just got into it.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's listening to the special. It's really interesting. You have the part where your dad punches your mom and there's like there's a laugh there, but it's like it's not a clear laugh. And then the same thing happens when you say he punches your little brother. There's like noises, like people are laughing, but it's almost like they don't know how else to react. You know, from your perspective, what are they laughing at? What does it feel like? What are you looking for when you're telling that part of the joke?
To me, it feels like they were tickled to death in the beginning. You know, like they're like laughing because somebody's tickling them.
Yeah.
But then, you know, like, you know, when your brother's tickling you and then you stop and then like, you don't want to be, you're not laughing no more. Now it's being annoying, like, stop. So that's how I feel it's happening to the audience.
Mm.
But they also love the joke. I've had people walk up to me. He goes, man, the same thing happened to me in my house.
Yeah.
But the way you said it, I never saw it that way. But they tell me thanks.
Yeah, which is it? I think the thing that's really interesting, which is you're capturing what this looks like from a child's perspective. You know, that next part where you like start acting as a kid and you pee yourself and you go like, no. Is that what you think people respond to? That you sort of like capture a sort of innocence while this sort of horrible thing is happening?
I think if I were to do that joke, like I said, like an adult, it wouldn't get a laugh, but I'm showing like an innocence of a child, you know, who's watching a horrible thing happen to him. And somehow he got involved by not being involved. And now he's taking all the blame for everything.
Yeah.
And like, hey, man, what did I do? And now that when you mentioned that, it reminded me when Richard Pryor would imitate a little child, I guess, and that would always get a big laugh, and you would get into it. Or when the first time I saw Howie Mandel's HBO special, when he did Little Bobby,
yeah,
you're like feeling bad, but then you start laughing again. I mean, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I just felt bad for Bobby, and now I'm laughing my ass off.
So the joke goes on, and you say, you know, my mom had a fucking black eye. My brother, too, had a big black eye, and I felt like I wasn't part of the family. Can you talk about that feeling? What do you want to convey to the audience there?
Oh, man. That really happened.
Yeah.
That really happened, man. The next day, none of us went to school because of what happened, and my dad was asleep, man, like passed out like a coal miner. Mm-hmm. Like somebody that worked at the Ford plant for 12 hours. My dad would work 12 hours, I guess.
Yeah.
And I remember, man, my brother was, he did have a busted eye and shit. My mom too. They look like pandas. and I can't believe my mom said that, you know? Like, you didn't even help.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you could tell it's a real thing. I mean, like, what's it like acting out that part where she's sort of yelling at you?
It's tough because I am the oldest kid, you know?
Yeah.
And that's my little brother. But between you and I, my brother and I are like 10 months apart.
Yeah.
We're like Irish twins, everybody says. But I never met any Irish twins.
Yeah.
You know? My mom got pregnant while she was breastfeeding me, I guess. Mm-hmm. So there's that rivalry between my brother and I. Like, it was deep already, you know, before that even happened, it was already deep rivalry. Mm-hmm. Like, my brother ended up going to out of this situation because my brother stepped in and got a black eye. Mm. My brother ended up being the favorite after that. Like after that day, I was withdrawn from the family, I guess. I mean, I was there, but not really there. Mm-hmm. My brother was going to a different school than me.
Yeah.
And he got on this program, and he ended up going to live in Mexico City. It was a rich-ass family. I mean, this family was the rich. They're Mexicans who live in Mexico City.
Yeah.
And my brother lived with them for 2 weeks. My brother went to see pyramids, bro. He saw Mayan structures. He ate lobster. And this is all behind my back. Like, I never knew about this. Like, or else I would have tried to figure this out. How could I go? But none of them was done behind my back. And 2 weeks later, my brother comes back with a Mexican kid from Mexico who's rich, okay?
Yeah.
Who's rich. And my brother conned that kid, you know. Probably catfished him and lied on the application because there was no way in hell they would send a rich kid to live in the projects.
Yeah.
You know? Like, we were living in the fucking projects, bro. Like, that kid came to America to share a room with three other people. That's on my next special, man. But still, I'm going to talk about that my next special. But I can't believe that kid had to live with us for 2 weeks. I mean, this kid was rich, bro. Like, he would go buy ice cream when he was hanging out with us just for him.
Yeah.
We were at the swimming pool. This fool was laying down on the floor tanning wearing Speedos.
Are you
bitter about that? Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you have such strong feelings about like.
I mean, everything that my brother went on to, you know, he went on to steal my identity, you know, later on in life. Like, when I was on Last Comic Standing, the NBC lawyer, private investigator of personal affairs, I guess.
Yeah.
He dug up. He came back and said, you know what, Felipe, you have two outstanding bench warrants for not appearing in court for two different drug offenses. And I said, well, I'm going to tell you right now, that's not me. I said, that's my brother. I think he stole my identity. Here's a picture of him. Go match the photos and don't kick me off the show. And I mean, ended up being my brother, man.
Are you considering how much, you know, the pain or just sort of feeling you have around this? What are you hoping the audience is laughing at parts of it, but also conveying how hard this is? Like you don't want, you know, it's clear that you don't want this joke to sort of let the story off the hook of being just sort of like a happy story. You like want it to be hard. Do you want it to be hard to listen to at points as well?
Yeah, I do, because it's real.
Yeah.
I want it to be hard to listen to because, you know, even though it's a joke, it's still real to me, you know. I hope people don't, well, you know, you can't avoid that. I hope people don't take it the wrong way and say, oh, he's promoting domestic violence or beating up women or whatever, beating up kids. But so far, I've done that joke in Birmingham, Alabama. People laugh. It was all white. People laughed. I've done it all over the country. People laughed. I've done it in Spanish. And when I do it in Spanish, I feel like I get a bigger laugh. My mom heard that joke in English when in New York City, when I was first workshopping that joke, trying it out, like a year and a half ago. We were in New York City in Caroline's Comedy Club. And my mom heard that joke. And every time she heard it, I could see that she probably was reliving it and then laughing at my exaggeration of the story. Because she told me, she said, it never happened that way. She said, you wish we went to Disneyland.
Yeah.
But my dad would just take her to different places on different occasions, you know? Like he'll take her to SeaWorld or Marineland back in the days. Like, my dad would never plan anything, you know? Like, I knew he was sorry for something. If we, like, that's why a lot of people, like, when you see immigrants in the beginning, you see them and you go, wow, they're dressed like they're going to a wedding.
Yeah.
You know, they're wearing their best. Did somebody graduate? Is there a quinceañera at hot dog on a stick? Is there a quinceañera at Whataburger? Is somebody getting married at Well, man, because see what happens is that most immigrants or most dads, you know, they don't know how to communicate and tell everybody where they're going. So we just left church to tell the truth. I wouldn't dress like I'm gonna film Saturday Night Fever or The Wedding Singer, you know, if I knew I was gonna go to a Dodger game.
Yeah. So Disneyland was just sort of a way of capturing all of those experiences?
No, man, we did go to Disneyland. And the reason we went to Disneyland because prior to not going ever to Disneyland, my grandmother would always yell at my father for being drunk, you know, yell at him like he was 8. And we were in on the west side. My grandma, she lived by the Olympic Auditorium. She lived over there on the west side. And I remember she asked me, have you ever been to Disneyland? I said, never been to Disneyland. Never. Man, and I emphasize never in Spanish. Yeah. Nunca. Nunca. And my dad came drunk with me to the house, and she was yelling at him, how could you be so irresponsible? How could you have a job, a family, and get drunk and never take them to Disneyland? Don't you know that everybody wants to go to Disneyland? That's the reason people come to America, is to go to Disneyland.
Yeah.
They want to see Mickey Mouse. She was mispronouncing everything. Yeah. Get in the Miguel Mouse, right? Miguel Mouse and Daffy Duck. So like, that must have stuck in my dad's head when he was already drunk that day. Mm. So the next day, that's when we went to Disneyland, and we were fucking shell-shocked, bro. PTSD, man. Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, I mean, you say it's you're traumatized at Disneyland. The Donald Duck part where you're sort of doing the voice and then you explain why that's so traumatizing is such an extreme combination of so silly and also really sad at the same time. Can you talk about marrying those two things and what you're hoping for that part of the joke?
When I first started doing stand up comedy, I would like I said, I like the comedians that I met along the way, they all came from I guess from set up punchline background, you know. So I learned from them, and also learned that they had a lot of tags, you know. Like I remember watching these 80s comedians on Fox. They had like the Fox stand up comedy shows, you know. Like I remember a guy named Tom Carter, you know, and Bobby Collins, you know. These guys, they were like joke machines, you know, and they were a lot of tags after every joke, you know. And I said, you know, I'm gonna try that. But what they're really doing is they're dissecting their joke and stretching it out as much as possible, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
Because their goal, you know, that era of comedians, you know, those guys, they wanted to get on a Tonight Show.
Yeah.
So they knew that Johnny likes jokes. Johnny likes jokes. Johnny Carson likes jokes. You know, so they would write tags, you know, because I guess a Tonight Show is it's a 4.5 minute set. So you try to like throw in as much jokes as possible into the set to have a nice set. But so when I write a joke, I try to come up with as much tags and as much jokes possible on the subject. I try to listen to the joke as the audience member first and foremost, and then as the comedian, and then as the comedian who's trying to help that comedian structure that joke.
Oh, interesting.
So when I get to the structuring part, I write the joke as a coming from a guy who's been doing it for 20 years. I try to rewrite the joke in a way that it doesn't sound the same anymore. Or like in a way that I could look at myself and go, hey, you just took my joke. Nah, I just rewrote it. So... And once I get comfortable, I try to find a comfortable spot where the joke is working everywhere, you know. I don't got to change nothing. And then I start adding my little numbers to it, you know. What else could I take it, you know? Daffy Duck, you know. Or I could just say, I was like discombobulated, man, at Disneyland, like Goofy. I don't know what was going on. But that's not funny. No, Daffy Duck sounds like somebody getting choked.
Yeah. So it's really just sort of like, okay, we have the true part and we're going to find different ways of doing it. And you're like trying to figure out a way of heightening it where it still feels true enough, but also like pays off the sort of longer story of like what's a really big sort of thing you could perform out.
Yeah.
So the joke ends with you saying, and that's why I like cocaine. Why? What are you trying to tell the audience at that point?
I'm letting the audience know that I didn't choose to use cocaine at a party or peer pressure or any other elements that the media or they try to spin on you, you know? I'm just letting you know that this was never dealt with in my family. There was never no closure, you know? We're gonna put it in our mind in a shelf, and later on, in our 40s, when we start dealing with it, we're gonna scream at night and we're gonna cry. We're gonna see a movie about a father and son, and we're gonna cry, hear that song by I guess Jim Croce. But like growing up, I would not understand when a grown man that I know, a friend of mine, calls his parents every day or has to call his mom and dad every week. Or me and my dad are going to go fishing. Me and my dad are going to hang out. How old is your dad? Because I don't know what that relationship is like.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more Felipe Esparza.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
And we're back with Felipe Esparza. So the other thing I want to talk about in terms of writing this joke is, you know, this special you're releasing both in English and in Spanish. And I want to talk a little bit about the differences between the two. But first, just what inspired you to release the special in two languages?
I wanted to challenge myself. And when I was approached by Netflix for the English, I said, how about we do a Spanish one too for more money? No. I said, let's try both. Let's try to release both. Because I knew that here in America, Netflix has 76 million subscribers. But all over the world, like worldwide, you know, worldwide, it has to be 176 million people, you know?
Yeah.
Because 76 million is just the United States, all of South America must be more, and then so on. So I wanted to reach everybody, and I also wanted to bring the American style of stand up to Spanish speaking audiences, you know, in other parts of the world. You know, because I'm from Boyle Heights, you know, and like, you know, where I'm from. There's a little type of flavor, you know, a little East LA, Boyle Heights flavor. Like people around the world already know, you know, from watching movies like Blood In, Blood Out, American Me, you know, the lowrider culture. Mm-hmm. It has transcended and crossed over to Japan even, you know. People over there, they like our culture. I even have these two fans from Morocco who know all the quotes from the Chicano movie Blood In, Blood Out.
Yeah.
And that was such a surprise to me, you know, and very cool. And they're from Spain. They speak Spanish, you know, but they live in Morocco and they're both Muslim. They wear the hijabi, you know. I never seen their face, but I never seen the rest of their body. You know, they're Muslim. That's their culture.
Yeah.
And I figure if they understand blood in, blood out, I have to do a Spanish stand-up comedy yeah. show coming from the Mexican-American perspective, you know? Because there's a lot of comedians from Mexico coming over here and doing specials. And my Spanish isn't that good when it yeah. comes to, like, professional Telemundo, CNN, you know, Galavision, ESPN Español. Like, if you're speaking too fast, you need to slow that shit down, homie, because I speak Cheech and Chong level.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're hilarious, you know, these guys from Mexico. But I'm speaking from a Mexican-American point of view. Yeah. If I don't understand it, there's got to be other people who don't understand it. So I better my Spanish, and I better do a Spanish comedy show for the people in Latin America who want to hear a stand-up comedian from the United States.
Considering, as you said, your Spanish isn't necessarily so good, what was the process like translating the act?
I started off, first of all, there's not enough time, you know, to go into a comedy club and do 20 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, like the comedians I've seen, like Dave Chappelle and Dan Cook, Carlo Mencia, Joe Rogan. They work out their acts, you know, at comedy clubs in the city. But I don't have time, you know. That's good, you know, if you're doing an English special. Mm-hmm. But I was doing a Spanish one. And there were not that many Spanish avenues or Spanish comedy shows to pick from. So I called this comedy club, the Comedy Palace in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And I asked the guy, I heard you guys have comedies in Spanish. He said, yeah, we have a headliner coming in from Mexico on Sunday. Sold out two shows. And I said, all right. Ask her if I could open for her. Like, for real, it's like
yeah.
a headliner. I'm a headliner in English, you know. I knew that. But I had to humble myself. And, you know, and I'm stepping into a different lane, you know.
Yeah.
I don't speak great Spanish to be up there trying to bump somebody in.
Yeah.
Stay up there forever. So I politely asked if I could open, and she said yes. She was awesome, and I got to meet other Spanish comedians there from Mexico. One of them was named Joel Sotomayor, mm-hmm. and this guy was cool, man. He followed me to three English shows in Fresno and Salinas, California, and Bakersfield, and then he transcribed all my stand-up from English to Spanish.
Wow.
And he just transcribed it. But once I read it, I said, wow, it's going to be harder than I thought because these jokes, they don't sound funny in Spanish.
Yeah. It's hard to describe what that process is of like, okay, you have the words, but is it a way of explaining of like, what is the difference of like, okay, this is what it looks like translated, but this is what it would need to be like to sort of sound correct? How would you describe what the difference is between what you needed to do to make it work?
Well, my Spanish, it's a mixture of Spanglish and a thing called Chicanics. Mm-hmm. It's like a Chicano man speaking Spanish and English, Chicanics, and Spanglish. It's a Mexican man speaking Spanish but mixing the words up with English. And making up words that only exist in your neighborhood. So on one of the jokes, I kept messing it up. I mean, people laughed, but phonetically, I was saying it wrong.
Yeah.
I was saying, los robaron. That means the robbers.
Mm-hmm.
When you translate it, the robbers, los robaron. But I wanted to say they robbed us.
Yeah.
But for anybody besides the people that were at the show, they knew that I meant they robbed us. Mm-hmm. But to everybody else who doesn't know me, who are probably watching a show in the Dominican Republic, they're probably wondering, what does that mean? But see, being that I speak more English than Spanish and being stubborn and being American, it sounds better this way. I'll say it this way.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the American attitude, you know?
Yeah.
I'll just say it this way because it sounds better and they already know what I said.
Yeah, yeah. They know what you mean.
But man, yes, that was a tough part. And also, play on words in English do not work in Spanish.
Yeah, I can imagine. How did the Spanish-speaking audiences respond to material differently? Did this joke in particular, the one we're talking about, play differently? Did you have to take it tonally in different directions?
Oh, man. When I said that joke in Spanish the first time, people lost their mind. Like, they laughed loud. Mm-hmm. Because I was doing a very short set, and that was like my closer. So I left on that Disneyland part, and I said, buenas noches, good night. They don't know what they got hit with, you know,
yeah.
But I know that they wanted more. They wanted more explanation, what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But when I say it in Spanish, it's more personal to me than I think. Now I know it's more personal than when I say it in English. Like, I feel like I'm good about it. And it flows better, man, like a song.
Mm-hmm. Was it because your parents were speaking Spanish at the time, so you're more in the language of actually what was spoken at the time, or you're more in that moment?
I think because my parents were speaking Spanish and everything happened in Spanish, but also the Spanish language, very rhythmic, rhythmatic, if that a word, it's in a rhythm, you know? So, like, if I were to say that in English, you know, like, if I were to sing what I just said in English, it would sound good,
mm-hmm.
but it wouldn't be funny.
Yeah.
But in Spanish, I could say, por eso te pegaron, cabrona. Por eso te pegaron. You know? Mm-hmm. Porque no te cae la boca. You know, it just sounds good. Like, from watching so many Spanish movies and also Spanish novelas, you know, Spanish soap mm-hmm. operas, I felt the need, you know, and to throw a little bit more. You know what? I think Spanish people, us, were mm-hmm. more, we're very over-dramatic anyways.
Yeah.
If you watch our movies, if you watch our novelas, all these women, they're very over-dramatic. So when I got to do the jokes in Spanish, I felt free to be as over-dramatic mm-hmm. as I want to because that's what I'm used to seeing in Spanish.
That's interesting. So even in your first special, they're not going to laugh at you. You have a joke about your dad hitting y'all as well, where you say, you know, my dad used to be a professional wrestler in Mexico, so when he hit us, he didn't really hit us. So, which was much more the style of the jokes you told at the time. Can you talk about when you wrote that joke and if that sort of was tapping into those same feelings, and then also sort of like how you evolved as a comedian to be able to tell the full story?
I kind of feel like back then I was just hiding behind my comedy, my true feelings, you know, of making everything funny. Like when I said that my dad would walk around the whole neighborhood and bring out furniture and bring it home and collect it and fix it like MacGyver with duct tape. One time he brought a television home and that TV had 500 channels, but it was a knob from the oven.
Yeah.
That joke, man, that joke came out of the truth that really happened. And my dad we had a washing machine, man. My dad bought a washing machine. I don't know if he bought it stolen, used, or he found it. But we had a washing machine that only worked if you put two quarters in.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a coin washing machine in our house that had to take quarters. And then after the wash, the two quarter would come out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the joke came out of that stuff too.
In general, why talk about these darker, more painful subjects? Either why do it for what you want from your comedy, or why even for yourself are you telling these stories?
I feel that I tell these stories now because as a comedian, you know, as the most comedians, you know, you keep evolving.
Yeah.
You know, like the Beatles were different from 1964 to 1971 when they broke up. You know, they were more what the Beatles were supposed to be, you know. That's what they wanted to be. At first, they sound a little bluesy, you know. They sound like, you know, they pretty much took all the blues songs, all the African American songs, American mm-hmm. blues, and made it rock and roll. You know, they took Little Richard songs, you know, and they made it sound like the Beatles. But then later on, the Beatles became their own sound, you know, their own sound.
Yeah.
That's who they became. Sgt. Pepper, Lonely Hearts Club Band, you know. Imagine, you know. You know, all those, they became that, you know, the mm-hmm. White Album. You know, that's who the Beatles are. And as a comedian, you know, you don't know who you are yet until you become comfortable in your space, you know. And I have not reached that part yet in my life, but it's a nice, you know, voyage, you know, to say. Mm-hmm. It's not about the destination, man.
Yeah, yeah.
It's about the other stuff, the travel.
Journey. Yeah.
The journey.
Does telling these stories on stage, what does it do for you? Does it help you process them?
My stories first are come to life on my podcast.
Yeah.
Or whenever I'm a guest on someone's podcast, like when I was on the Champs
yeah.
with Neil Brennan and Moshe Kasher, that was the first time I think I talked about crossing the border illegally mm-hmm. and my little sister dressing up. And I think that's the first time I shared that story. And they were like blown away. I think Neil Brennan said, wow, there's like 5 movies in just yeah. 1 hour of speaking to you. He goes, have you ever thought about making that into a set? He goes, I don't know. I've been told to say that on stage, but I guess I will now.
Yeah. But I guess does telling it on stage and having people laugh at it or having people come up to you and being like, I relate to this story, does it make you feel better about it? You know, you talk about how the story came from the fact that you were just, this memory was keep on playing over and over again. Does performing it either release the memory or just sort of lessen its power over you? Does that make sense?
I think it helps mm-hmm. to say it over and over, but I think the pain is still there when I say it, or a little memory of it comes back that I don't remember, you know, something different about it. You know, like if I were to remember something about it, like now I remember now, is that my other brother, the one that dressed up like Patty, the one that had to dress up a little mm-hmm. girl, he used to wet his pants all the time.
Yeah.
After, like, even though he was not involved or he saw it, but he didn't see the violence on him. Like, he was not hit by anybody or he was not treated by anybody bad, but he saw everything happen. Mm-hmm. Now when I think about it, you know, I'm thinking, right, well, he did wear his pants all the way till he was 14, you know, and that was never dealt with either.
And what do you hope for the audience when they take in a story like this? And what do you hope they think about you or think about the situation? Or, you know, what is your relationship to audiences in general?
I hope people can watch the whole set and laugh. And then come back to that part and say, wow, this was a hard to watch, but it was a healing process for me.
Yeah.
I could relate to this. And I better go tell somebody sorry, or I forgive you. I don't know you were going through this. Or maybe, you know, when they watch the Spanish set together, they could look at their dad and go, this is you, motherfucker. Or they could laugh at it and be a family.
Yeah. You mentioned your mom saw this joke. In general, has your dad heard about it? Has your dad watched it? What does your dad think about being talked about on stage this way?
My dad has not watched a set or anything like that.
In general, how do your parents feel about being talked about on stage?
My mom doesn't care. She got to be on Last Comic Standing with me, and we had a little moment, you know, on Last Comic Standing, a little teary-eyed moment. So mm-hmm. she didn't like the attention that she got afterwards in public. Like, hey, you're Felipe's mom. She just didn't like that part, being approached in the streets. But as far as the material goes, she doesn't have Netflix, you know, and
yeah.
My brothers don't talk to her about the material, I guess. Mm-hmm. But she's seen the set already live. And oh my God. When we were in New York City, there was a big crowd of people, you know, waiting for the meet and greet.
Yeah.
And then my mom was standing next to me, that's my mom right there. What? And they want to take photos with her.
You know, considering, you know, they came to this country, I've heard you talk about in hopes of giving you and your siblings more opportunities. How have they appreciated your success?
My mom was very happy, you know, so was my dad. My dad, like, he had the little, even though he never said it, I know that he always had, like, the vibe, you know, like, the buzz, you know, like the Hollywood buzz, you know. Like, when you were a little kid, you would watch a cartoon or somebody that has a Hollywood buzz, yeah. And they go to Hollywood. And when I was a kid, I would watch cartoons about little dogs going to Hollywood and becoming famous and then not making it, and then the little hobos.
Mm-hmm.
That's always the fear. But my dad always, I know that he always wanted to be somebody in film, but not never like told anybody, because I remember being in El Paso featuring for Joy Medina, and I get a call from somebody. He goes, dude, put it on channel 52.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm in El Paso. There is no 52 over here. He goes, your father is on television with your brother on the People's Court, but the Mexican version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, that's not my brother, but that is my dad, and they're both lying, and they got paid to be on television.
You won Last Comic Standing 10 years ago to this month.
Wow.
In August. Yeah. And it came about 15 years into you doing comedy. How has the last 10 years compared to the first 15?
Well, the last 10 years, I didn't have to worry about paying my rent or count my money, you know, or count my gigs, you know, for the next gig.
Yeah.
Like, before Last Comic Standing, I was hustling, man. I was making, like, sometimes $50 a show to do 10 minutes, sometimes 100, sometimes 150, 200 if I'm lucky. But I would line up my shows all week just to have enough money to pay my rent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would have to do like 15 shows a week. I would do like, I would do like the Laugh Factory on Latino night on Monday. Mm-hmm. And Tuesday night, I would have to go to a place in the ghetto of Rosemead called Casa Latina. And let me tell you, man, that place was tough. Like, I would see people like J.B. Smooth, Ralphie May, Jay Lamont, Cat Williams. But he was not called Cat Williams. Mm-hmm. He was called Cat in a Hat. And these guys would walk in there, man, and monsters, bro.
Yeah.
And I would walk in there, too, just to make $50. And then on Wednesdays, I had my own spot, you know, where I made $75. And I would book comedians, you know, like one time Sean Wayans came, Paul Rodriguez. So many great comedians came through there. This is all in the hood, man, the east side.
Yeah.
Then Thursday, there was a comedian named Rudy Moreno who had the Normandy Casino. And some other people had other shows in Inglewood. I remember this guy had a show in Inglewood that paid $100. Friday nights, Laugh Factory, 10 o'clock show, and midnight show. I would hustle, man. I did not have a car. I remember I would have to catch a bus to the Comedy Store, one bus, to do the 8 o'clock show. And then right there on Fairfax, I would have to catch a bus to Hollywood Boulevard to catch the train to downtown LA, and then another train to Long Beach to do the Long Beach 10 o'clock show. And then I would come back to the Laugh Factory to do the midnight show with Tiffany Haddish, Brian Holtzman, Leslie Jones,
yeah,
and all these comics who are pretty much doing so well now. Good for them.
Knowing that, knowing all of that, what has it been like these last 10 years?
Man, I still like performing. I still like to hustle, man. I love stand-up more. And it's more fun now because people are showing up. I was surprised, like, when I was on Last Comic Standing. Like, as soon as I won Last Comic Standing, things changed. I was doing the Last Comic Standing tour, which was 85 cities all over America. And then I would meet everybody up at the Laugh at the big show for the Last Comic Standing tour. And man, when I did a show in DC, that show sold out in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never done that before. I remember when the manager of the improv, she gave me my check. She told me that she doesn't make that in a month. No, she doesn't make that in a week.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you better start writing jokes, lady, or move to Hollywood and become an agent. Because that's how managers who work at comedy clubs do it.
Yeah. What's been more fun, just having an audience and knowing the comfort that you can actually sort of not worry about hustling to just get shows, but you can focus on hustling to have your material be what it needs to be?
I think what's been more fun is the traveling and doing a bunch of shows all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And to go to places that I would never thought I would go, and people actually would know that I'm coming there. Like, I did a show and for 500 people in a small little theater in Hilo, Hawaii. Hilo.
Yeah.
Like, I did a show in Honolulu with Paul Rodriguez, like, the next day. But I flew into Honolulu. I did press. And the next day, I went to Hilo to do a comedy show. And man, like, there was a lot of people there, like a lot of people. I cannot believe there was people actually who moved from my neighborhood who live in Hilo.
You mentioned all those years ago writing down three goals, and one was to do stand up, and one was to be happy with what you're doing. Have you done all of them? Have you been to Italy, or at least are you happy?
No, I have not gone to Italy, but I have listened to The Godfather on Audible 2 times,
mm-hmm,
and seen the movie a bunch of times. And I'm trying to pick up a little bit of Italian there and here and there. But for the most part, I'm very happy. You know, I do what I can, you know, to help out young comics. I tell young comics now that I can't give you the advice that was given to me, because when I was given the advice that I was given, it was for a different time, mm-hmm, in comedy, in a different time in our world, in a different mindset of the kind of person that I was. But I'll tell you this right now, if I was to give you advice, I'll tell you this. You have more tools than I ever had when I first got started. Mm. And the person that gave me that advice couldn't fathom the much of tools you have right now. Like, you don't have to go out to look for a tape recorder. It's already on your phone. You don't have to go buy a fucking camcorder. It's already on your phone. You don't have to go to the Yellow Pages to look for an agent. It's on your phone.
Yeah.
You know, when I bought a comedy book, Jess.
Yeah.
I bought a comedy book that the librarian told me also. Yeah. When I went back the following week, it was called How to Write Funny, How to Be Funny, and how to make money out of being funny. Mm-hmm. And in that comedy book, it broke down the genres of comedy. Like, it had one section, deadpan, and it was Stephen Wright and whoever was a deadpan comedian of the time. And then on the other side, it had satirical or whatever.
Yeah.
Comedians, it had all the ones, you know. And then it had, you know, what was great about that comedy book, on the back of the book, it had all the comedy clubs.
Mm.
And it had the numbers and the bookers and the agents of where to send your comedy tape to.
And now look at you. Your tape will be seen by the world.
Yes, man.
So now it's time for our final segment, which is the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because it's comedy, it's a laughing round. Do you have a favorite joke, like a street joke, just like or a dad joke?
My favorite joke is this one. Did you hear that when the guy who wrote the song, the Hokey Pokey, when he died, they couldn't close his coffin? Every time they put a right foot in, he put a left foot out.
Is there a joke that you wish you could steal in so much as it's another comedian's joke that you saw and you're like, I wish I had that joke, but it's not like you'd get caught for stealing. It's another dimension where everything's the same, but you have this joke.
Oh man, there's so many jokes that people write that I feel like, damn, I was just talking about that. But I guess I would say that Ronnie Dangerfield's punchlines, you know?
Yeah.
And whatever Mitch Hedberg has written, those are all great jokes. But off the top, I would have to say that Hannibal Buress joke about his favorite burrito restaurant closing, his taco truck restaurant, his favorite taco restaurant closing. Yeah, that one.
Do you do any impersonations that you never have an opportunity to do, but I will give you an opportunity if you have any?
I don't do impersonations, but when I do try to, when I was learning Spanish or getting used to Spanish, I was watching a lot of Pablo Escobar. Mm-hmm. So when I would do a set, my set would sound like Pablo Escobar.
It's like Pablo Escobar doing Stephen
stand up comedy. Pues anoche que vi a la tienda, tú sabías.
Do you have a comedy crush? A person in comedy whose comedy you have a crush on? It's not romantic. You just like their comedy a lot.
Yes. There's a comedian out of Canada named Stuart Francis.
Mm-hmm. What do you like about it?
Oh, man. His comedy is ridiculous, bro. He had a running gag about his father taking him swimming. And he had a joke about, he says, you never know how close a frisbee is till it hits you.
And last one, do you have a joke that didn't work, that you've tried over and over again, that you really thought was funny but didn't work? Maybe you've given up on it, but you'll go to your grave being like, I was wrong. I mean, they're wrong. I was right. This joke is funny.
Oh, man. I can't, off the bag, I can't think of any right now, but one joke that has always worked that never, no one likes. What joke you don't like? It never works. Oh, an abortion joke I have. We cut it off the special, we cut it off the set. Because I had said that I went to I liked the joke. I said I went to a gender revealing party. Mm-hmm. And I tried out this joke, by the way, at the comedy store right after Gesso Nick, and I figured, like, wait a minute, I have 10 jokes that I could try out now since they're laughing at his stuff, yeah. Right? So I went to a gender revealing party, and when I got there, the girl said she got an abortion. and then when the balloon blew up, it sprayed blood at everybody.
Yeah, I could see that night not be for all audiences.
Yeah.
But that is it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Hope it comes out good, man. Have fun.
That's it for another episode of Good One. You can watch They're Not Gonna Laugh at You and Bad Decisions on Netflix. Follow Felipe on Twitter @FunnyFelipe and on Instagram @FelipeEsparzaComedian. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Hannah Rosen, and Camila Salazar. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing round suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us @GoodOnePodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me @JesseDavidFox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with another comedian and another joke. Have a good one.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.